You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with RAFA, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004. Today, we're in Montpellier.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And our old amigo, Daniel Freeb.
Hello, chaps. Lionel, where are we? And Richard, where are my contact lenses?
They're in the boot of the car. The boot of our slightly scratched car.
Is this week two or three? I've forgotten.
Week two.
Mm-hmm. And I still haven't got them. Anyway.
But can you see okay?
Fumbling around.
Mr. Magoo.
Trying my best, but... yeah, it's a struggle. Anyway.
Oh, well. We'll try and get those to you before the end of the tour. Where are we, Lionel?
We're outside Montpellier's rugby ground, the Stade de la Mosson. It's the regular press room venue, regular finish line venue, whenever the tour is in Montpellier. It has been at least a couple of times in recent years. I think Mark Cavendish won very close to here. And there was a team time trial in 2009 when Lance Armstrong almost took the yellow jersey, but didn't.
We almost missed it all because we were doing a folding bike race, weren't we, Daniel?
Yeah.
And we got lost. Anyway, the tale of the attack, please, Lionel.
Of course. Stage 11 of the Tour de France from Carcassonne to Montpellier in the south of France, 162.5 kilometres. The wind was predicted to blow, and blow it did, although it didn't wreak quite the havoc that we may have anticipated. A couple of riders got off the front, Lee Howard of I Am Cycling and Arthur Vichot, the French champion, perhaps anticipating Bastille Day tomorrow. Perhaps getting it wrong, I don't know. Anyway, the crosswinds didn't really cause too much trouble in the first two-thirds of the stage, and Howard and Vichot were caught with still 60 kilometres to go. There were a few crashes. Rafał Majka and winner Anacona were a couple of the riders who hit the ground. And then when the splits did occur, it was Thibaut Pinot, the current king of the mountains, who was off the back. Michael Matthews was also in the second group at one point when the peloton split into two. 35 kilometres to go, it was all back together, and... well, we thought it was going to end up in a sprint. The sprinters' teams were all at the front. But on the run into Montpellier, around roundabouts, with the wind blowing, Peter Sagan, he seized the initiative, and he was joined by a teammate, Maste Bodnar. Chris Froome reacted to that. The yellow jersey, the green jersey. Geraint Thomas was also in there, and that four-rider group worked incredibly well together, and at one point the time gap was showing us 21-22 seconds to everybody else who had lost out. It came down a bit on the line where Peter Sagan took his second stage win of the race. Chris Froome gained 6 seconds on the bunch, add another 6 for the time bonus, and that's a 12 second game over Nairo Quintana and the rest. So Froome still in yellow with a slightly bigger advantage than he had last night. Peter Sagan now very securely in green. Thibaut Pinot is in the polka dot jersey, and the white jersey is still with Adam Yates. Tomorrow, the Mont Ventoux stage, because of high winds on Mont Ventoux, the stage has been shortened and will now finish at Chalet Reynard, which is around 6 kilometres from the summit.
So that was a pretty dull stage, wasn't it, guys?
Yeah, I mean, pretty boring when the green and yellow jerseys get up the road in the last few kilometres and swap turns on the front with a couple of domestiques helping out as well. Boring.
Well, boring.
Funny to say that it was boring because I had half an hour last night with Oleg Tinkov, and he was talking about tomorrow's, well, what is today's stage? It was tomorrow's stage yesterday. And he said, and he used stages like this one as a pretext for basically inventing things to put in the press. He said, I asked him about the quote that he came out with a few days ago, that if Peter Sagan won 2 more stages, then he would carry on in cycling and he would renew his sponsorship of the team. I said, well, was he serious about that? And he said, no, sometimes you have to make a fun because it's boring. Like a stage like tomorrow is boring, 6 hours. No one want to watch that.
So I forgot to mention that we had an Oleg Tinkov interview in tonight's podcast. That was it there. Well, it's weird. Well, two things on that. First of all, was Peter Sagan trying to sabotage the chances of Oleg carrying on by trying to let his teammate win today, Bodnar? He wanted him to win.
Really?
He did, yeah. He said that in the press conference.
Right, I wasn't in the press.
Yeah, no, he wanted him to win the stage, and it did look like that, but he sort of sensed that Froome was obviously going for as many seconds as he could, and it was dangerous to do that.
He tried to do that with Oscar Gatto at the 3 days of the Panna in 2013.
Yeah.
And it didn't manage it then either.
So he was maybe trying to sabotage that. But also he said in his press conference that he was asked about the rumours linking him with the Bora team, and he said no, he was going to stay with Tinkoff, who was going to start a Dacia team.
Not true.
Okay. Well, anyway, what a stage. I mean, I went and spoke at the finish to Nicolas Portal, the Team Sky sports director, who is one of the few members of Team Sky staff actually speaking to the press. So there seems to be a bit of a lockdown. Yeah. Well, Brailsford is.
Maybe.
Well, Portal's been very good.
Who else isn't speaking to the press?
Well, who is?
Anyone you ask, pretty much, no?
Well, anyway, we're not as much success as you, Daniel, but we don't go around with a big television camera behind us. Maybe that is an effect. Anyway, spoke to Nicolas Portal. Here's what he had to say. Nicolas, that seemed very opportunistic. Big effort made by Chris there. Was it worth it for the time gain?
Well, I think, you know, when you do something like this, you just go, and then you took some seconds, some bonus seconds, so I think it's fine, yeah. Happy with that.
Surprised that he was allowed to go?
He was?
Are you surprised that he was allowed to go?
Allowed? What do you
mean? Well, the yellow jersey was able to get a gap on a run-in like that.
Yeah, yeah, and also on the sprinted team and everything, but then you need to see who he was in the front, you know. Obviously, Jay came back straight away, and then Geraint Thomas, Chris Froome, Sagan, and his teammates. Is, you know, you have four guys committing 100%, and then you've got some sprinter team, where they are good on the flat, but you know, there's not the top. I mean, they're more the helper. So if you manage well, you can hold a gap like this for not so long, but it was just enough actually. So yeah,
is today a sign of how well Chris is going, or that he's worried about the mountains in Quintana there?
No. I mean, you're right. It's just the sign when you say, well, you're feeling good. When you do something like this, you feel good, and you don't. You know, even you have the Ventoux on the next day and the time trial. He said, okay, let's do it and we'll see. And I did, and it's just fantastic. When you're a little bit on the hard, you're not going to try that. You're happy to stay on the wheel. So, yeah, it's a good sign.
So, basically, as we heard there, I was asking Nicolas Portal if the effort that Chris Froome put in was worth it for the seconds gained. And Dave Brailsford talked about that as well. Brailsford said, was a bit more sort of ambiguous on that than Portal. He said, we'll find out. I mean, he did make a big effort. They were making a big effort behind as well. But the question, I suppose, is where was Nairo Quintana and where were Movistar?
Well, yeah, I mean, I spoke to Sean Yates at the finish and asked him exactly that question because, of course, Yates was sports director when Bradley Wiggins won the Tour for Sky. He's now sports director at Tinkoff. And I said, you know, is it worth the effort to gain relatively little amount of time? And he said, yeah, it's always worth the effort to try something. And he made the point that it wouldn't have been easy for Quintana back there in the peloton, or what was left, the front half of the peloton, because it was fast, it was windy, it was difficult to stay on the wheels, so an effort was still being made behind. It wasn't like he had just an armchair ride into the finish. It was hard for everybody. It's, of course, the big thing is with the day tomorrow, whether whether it was smart to go into the red with Mont Ventoux looming.
Well, it was interesting that Froome, when he was speaking in his press conference, was saying that the Ventoux stage, which has been shortened, that's been confirmed, it will finish at Chalet Reynard. He said that he would be riding tomorrow's stage up to Ventoux with Friday's time trial stage in his mind, and that he said that anybody who goes too deep on Ventoux will certainly pay for it the next day.
Well, I don't think he's going to have too much choice, because by all accounts the first 100 kilometres tomorrow are going to be almost as grueling as the Ventoux itself, because there will be crosswinds and they might be even stronger than they were today, and the terrain is more difficult, there are small climbs, so I think the first 100 kilometres tomorrow might be quite grueling.
Yeah, I mean, are we going to talk about the fact that Mont Ventoux has been shortened and the impact that might have?
Well, Froome didn't think it would have that much impact because the first part is so hard anyway. I mean, Daniel, you're the mountain man. What's your view on that? Will it actually, he said, it would maybe even make it a more intense day?
Yeah, I would agree with that, because, you know, we all know the mythology of Mont Ventoux, that when you get above the Chalet Reynard, then oxygen starts to drain from the air. I mean, this is all, none of this is really based in science or fact, but that's what people say. And they always do try to hold something back and try not to go too deep in the forest, which is the part which finishes at Chalet Reynard. It's the hardest part of the climb, and it's the part that they will still be doing tomorrow. So people do try to economise slightly, I think. And tomorrow, they won't have that in their mind, and the attacking, the serious stuff, is going to take place on the hardest part of the climb.
By all accounts, Quintana is a bit of a fighter, isn't he? Although he's not, I think on balance, he'll probably be quite happy that he's still within a minute of him, but he's taken a couple of body blows, hasn't he? No knockout, but a couple of body blows, and he'll be smarting a bit and feeling a bit silly.
Yeah, particularly in my view, as regards the selection of his team, and more than that, the recruitment, Movistar's recruitment. Why have they not got more riders who are capable of
especially
riding well in crosswinds?
Year.
And it's not the first time, it's not even the second time, it's about the third or fourth time in recent years that Movistar have been caught out. And they really needed a couple of steamrollers, don't they, to move Quintana up the peloton on days like this and really position him where he ought to be, where Chris Froome often is. I mean, I think Chris Froome is obviously much more suited to this kind of weather or these conditions anyway. But yeah, Movistar do look a bit silly tonight, unfortunately.
But don't you think, it's 31 seconds, Quintana 31 seconds behind Chris Froome overall, going into Mont Ventoux, he'll be delighted with that, surely, regardless of the small kind of dents to morale of today. And
no, I do agree, Lionel. If you see the bigger picture and you think about all the pitfalls that there could have been on the first week, and there always are, and you look at a rider like Thibaut Pinot, who just leaks time, year after year on the first week and the first 10 days, and to not have really done that and to only have lost 30 seconds is a bit of a triumph, I would agree, for Quintana. And let's not forget, he was in a much worse position when they got to the foot of the first mountain range last year, so he'll be pretty satisfied with that.
I think we should say that, because I think one or two people thought that we didn't give enough credit to Chris Froome the other day for his opportunistic attack and win. And I think today we have to give an awful lot of credit to Chris Froome. I mean, regardless of the discussion, the debate about whether it cost him, it was fantastic to watch. It was brilliant to see the yellow jersey attacking like that. It was a brilliant move. He was in the right place to follow Sagan when he went. But you have to be incredibly strong just to follow Sagan. We saw the effort that Geraint Thomas made to bridge that little gap and just made it across. Perfect composition of the group. A brilliant racing move and fantastic bike racing.
Absolutely. Thrilling to watch as well, because you could see the time gap going up, and then in the last kilometre and a half or so, it's very uncertain, and the number on the screen isn't necessarily reflecting. Of course, it's only 6 seconds on the line because the bunch was closing in behind. But how often do you really see that on a flat stage? Somebody laying
early.
It down. Exactly.
Sagan,
I'm struggling.
Collapsed in laughter in the press conference afterwards. He said it was very crazy. The green and the yellow jersey up the road in a 4-man break, and then he just did his giggle that he does. Sorry, my Sagan impression isn't as good as Daniel's Oleg Tinkoff impression. We did have we should probably mention this email that we received from Piers Atkinson. And he was talking about Movistar BMC Astana, stupid strategy was the subject line. And he basically said, we talk about Team Sky and Chris Froome a lot, but he thinks Chris Froome's challenges haven't come with a clear strategy and commitment to actually winning the Tour. The difference between Sky and other teams is Sky have a single-minded focus on supporting the leader to win the race. Movistar here with Valverde, Astana have got Aru and Nibali. BMC came in with two leaders, with Greg Van Avermaet doing his own thing. History has shown that the most successful riders in the Tour are those with the full support of their team. You cannot imagine Sky, including anyone in their lineup, who isn't absolutely clear that their role is to help their leader win. It's a fair point, a valid point.
I think any conclusions on that are premature at this stage.
Well, true, true.
Yeah,
two and three big Alpine stages to come, two time trials.
Yeah, we can't say. Who knows? Movistar's strategy might have been to keep everything absolutely locked down and very, very calm and very, very quiet for the first 10 days and see what the second half of the race brings. So let's reserve judgment. But it is a good point that You know, Sky do have a very, very single-minded focus. I mean, if you think back to 2012 when they had the best sprinter in the world, they pretty much left him on his own for 3 weeks while they put everything behind.
And it's why they've left Kwiatkowski at home, isn't it?
Well, not at home. He's racing it. Well, yes, at home. He's doing the Tour of Poland.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
And now, Pedaleur du Charme.
Thank you very much indeed to Eurosport for sponsoring the cycling podcast, along with Rafa, and Eurosport sponsor our daily Pedaleur du Charme award. I got a t-shirt to Tom Dumoulin this morning, spoke to him a bit about the time trial on Friday, which is a bit of a rehearsal for him for Rio. So we'll play that interview tomorrow evening. Look, it's Daniel, I'm afraid, has had to leave, but we've got a more than adequate replacement here. And we're just speaking of Pedaleur du Charme. Look who,
this is my contract.
Look who it is. It's David Miller. Give him your mic. It's David Miller.
Hello,
David.
Richard. How are you? I'm very good, thank you.
Got you on loan. Well, we're doing our Pedaleur du Charme, and who's today's Pedaleur du Charme? There's a few nominations for The Wind.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure how I'd present a t-shirt.
How do you qualify it?
Well, it can be anything. Just charming pedaling, elegance, class. I mean, a lot of nominations for Peter Sagan today for trying to let his teammate win.
That was, yeah. No, that's, we need to hear that for sure. But I think that's what happened.
We have heard it. He did confirm it, yeah.
Okay, good. We were right then. I don't know. You caught me off guard there. I might give it to Tessato for having ready to set off and set that whole plan in motion, and his gears didn't work.
Oldest man in the race.
I know. So he was about to do something amazing, which takes a lot of balls to kind of set that little action plan to go, and it all went wrong very quickly, and then Peter Sagan took it on himself.
So maybe a Pedaleur du Charme t-shirt would be nice, like consolation, compensation.
So your teammate won, we know Bodnar was amazing, but you were ready to set that in motion, and it didn't happen. So, yeah.
Otherwise, David, did you enjoy today's race?
I loved it. I love crosswinds, especially when they actually race it. And it's such a weird racing because it's so on-off. It's kind of, you don't really understand what's going on unless you've been in it. And it's kind of, the stress levels are bonkers. And it was good. And the finish was just stunning. To imagine a yellow jersey and a green jersey sprinting it out on a sprinter stage, that hasn't happened probably since the 1970s, I think.
That was good. We enjoyed it. We enjoyed it immensely. Chris Froome, will he regret the digging so deep today, or did he go so deep?
Don't know. Discussing that. I mean, it's obviously to do what he did, to do that bridge across that he did to Bodnar and Sagan. That's probably the most extreme thing that you do in cycling. It's harder than attacking on a climb. It's harder than prologues. It's harder than everything. And yet he seemed to be able to bridge across them. He's a climber. It was just mad.
Crazy. And Peter Sagan, you've said before, you know, just how extraordinary he is. But, you know, he does it again and again, doesn't he? Have you ever seen a bike rider like him?
No, never. I just was speaking with Matt White, director. We're just messaging. And he said, in 20 years, we'll be talking about Peter Sagan like we talk about Eddie Merckx now. None of us have ever seen anything like it. And you can't comprehend what he's like unless you've done it yesterday to do what he did, attack from kilometre zero, basically, and still be in control of the race at the end. And get second, so disappointing. But then today, pull it back together and rip the race to pieces on his own. That's just wrong.
Anything to say, Ned?
Great hair. Great hair. It's good hair.
Peter Sagan.
You numpty. You've got great hair, Richard.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Whoever you are, wherever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world. See rafa.cc for more information.
Thank you very much to Rafa for sponsoring us at the Tour de France. They are wonderful partners, and they're also covering the Tour de France in their own way. David Miller has reappeared on a folding bike. Oh, he's come to drain his cycling beer that he was imbibing. Thank you, David. Thanks very much for appearing on our podcast.
Sorry, Ned ruined it.
Bye. And Daniel left as well. So it's just you and me, Lionel. And thank you very much to Rafa, as I was saying. They're covering the race in their own way. If you go to the rafa.cc and more than a race, you'll find a daily article. Today is about feeding Team Sky, and it's a piece with their chef, which includes a recipe for rice bars, which is very interesting and quite complicated looking.
Talking of feeding on the race, one of our last year's Kilometre Zeros was on nutrition and feeding in the race, and we also did a slightly different take.
Giro.
Well, we did one on the team chef Garmin team, and then at the Giro we did one on more a sort of nutrition.
Yeah, race nutrition.
Check out our past Kilometre Zeros.
Check out our past. So then it was getting a bit surreal there for a moment, wasn't it, Lionel?
Podcast mashup. Mashup. Just, you know, it's like Children in Need night, isn't it, where sort of people from rival TV programs will come together.
Children in Need.
And we've got to do some kind of song and dance number at the end, is that right? I don't know. I'm so confused now. I'm not sure.
I'm really confused. I don't know where I am.
I wanted to talk about the Tour de France.
Okay.
And one other thing that happened today, riding high overall, another rider who'd had a very solid, quiet first half of the race, Joaquin Rodriguez, the Spanish rider with Katusha, who announced his retirement on the rest day. He's packing in at the end of the season. And he lost time in the split. And this is going back to our listeners' email about teams with single or double strategies. Alexander Kristoff, Katusha's sprinter, won the bunch sprint for fourth. They were very prominent at the front, while their potential podium hope was down the back a minute behind all the main players. And that illustrates the point very well. If you're trying to do two things at once on a day like today, when it's so chaotic and when, you know, the gap wasn't coming down enough, they really got that wrong on all fronts.
I did see a tweet that apparently at one point as well, Tinkoff were drilling at the front with Kreuziger off the back. You know, it's just basic. And Sky, for all their critics, they raced, and it is, as you say, early in the race, Lionel, but they raced extremely well today and in a very united way. Froome was gotten that move of sacking because he was in the right place.
But I also think that highlights that it sort of highlights that it's not possible for all the riders to know exactly what's going on, even with the race radios, even with the sports directors calling the shots. When it's that hectic, they're all... I think somebody said what the distance was between the front of the bunch and the back of the bunch, and it was hundreds of metres. You know, the peloton spread all across the road, going both sides of roundabouts, and it's chaotic. It's very difficult to know what's going on. You know, you catch sight of a teammate. It might not even be the right teammate. So, chaos out there on the road.
You know, for all that Froome was there and got in that move, you can't be at the right place all the time. There was an element of luck there too. A kilometre so earlier, it had been Richie Porte at the front. But, you know, you can't... It would be difficult to imagine him going with that, with Peter Sagan right enough. I mean, you've got to have really good legs to go with Peter Sagan at the moment, because the guy is, and David Miller said it there, he is writing himself into the history of cycling every day. And he did last year as well. He didn't win a stage last year, but the way that he races, the way he attacks, you know, he may have had an effect on the final outcome of the Tour today by the way that he rode. Nobody else could have done what he did today.
And he's going to break the green jersey record, isn't he? I mean, this will be number five, and barring disaster. And Eric Zabel has the record, six, although I'm not sure, did any of those get taken away with his confession for doping? I don't think they did.
Probably
I think it's
not.
Still in the books as six. But Peter Sagan is going to break that record, I'm sure. Just on the sprinters, though, Mark Cavendish, is that the last we've seen of him in this Tour de France? He had some kind of mechanical problem in the run-in.
Puncture, I think.
It was a puncture, was it? Right, yeah. And that was probably his last chance of a stage win.
It could be adios, Mark Cavendish. See you in Rio.
You wouldn't be surprised.
Well, another little thing that I noticed at the finish line, which I wanted to mention, was the presence of the police. There were an awful lot of police, more than I've ever seen, around the finish area and around the team buses in particular. A lot of plainclothes police, people with little labels on their belts that denoted them as police officers. Very hard to see, but I mean hundreds of them, and they were forming a ring around Team Sky where I was. It may have been at other buses as well, but you know, the security, we've talked about it a couple of times, definitely been stepped up a lot this year. But it's odd because there were a lot of
public in there
as well. So it was an odd situation where you let people in to the team bus area where riders are squeezing through narrow gaps of crowds and crowds of people, and those people are really forming quite a crush around the buses and loads of police people. It would be easier surely to just make those areas a bit more restricted.
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny one because that was probably, from our point of view, the least convenient finish because it was basically completely open to the public, and the public could get in and see their heroes, see all the biggest bike riders, biggest name bike riders in the world. I mean,
which is
amazing. Which yeah, yep. It is amazing.
I had my brother at the start this morning. That was nice.
Oh, very nice.
Brother and his friends who were on a holiday in the area came along to the start and thoroughly enjoyed it.
Super. So, the early break then had Lee Howard in it, a man who wasn't expecting to ride the Tour de France. He had ridden the Giro. He crashed and fell in a stream. He pulled out a few days after that, and the Tour de France was not on his race programme for I Am Cycling, and he was called up at very short notice when teammate Dries De Venins fell ill, I think it was. A couple of days ago, I spoke to Lee Howard about what it's like to suddenly find yourself riding the Tour de France when you had not expected to do so. You weren't expecting to ride the Tour de France this year. Tell me about the moment that the call came and when exactly that was.
It was on Wednesday morning, so I was just waking up and I got the phone call from the team. It was a nice way to wake up, that's for sure.
So you were excited to get that call, obviously.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was always on my plan to try and get a ride in the Tour, so I'd done most of my training in preparation, and then when I got told that I wasn't riding, it was quite disappointing. But, yeah, obviously to get the call was a real surprise and a happy surprise.
Listen to this lot. They're obviously they're here to see your Norwegian teammate.
Real Vikings, huh?
I mean, the Tour is the Tour. It's the old cliche. What's the first week been like for you? You obviously weren't called up as a sort of emergency replacement. You were fit and raring to go.
Yeah, I was fit and ready to go, but probably not. I wasn't 110% like you have to be for the Tour. So, you know, I was quite fresh. I'd had a week pretty easy before. I was still training, but not to the extent that you normally would if you knew you were racing the Tour de France. So, I come in a few percent underdone, but hopefully that'll help me in the next week or 2 weeks.
And lastly, what do you enjoy about Grand Tour racing, the rhythm and the routine of it, and how do you unwind at the end of a day?
I like the fact after you get through the first week, it gets a little bit more relaxing in some sense of the word, and you have some days, like today, that's a little bit more relaxing for the head, you know. It's still going to be a super tough day, and the next 2 days as well are going to be really tough. Mentally, it's a little bit easier because we don't have to fight for the sprints, but it's just a mix of everything, and you've always got something to look forward to. You get to really look forward to those rest days, and then you really enjoy them when they arrive. And I just think, ultimately, to get to the end of 3 weeks and finish in Paris or Madrid or Milan or wherever it is in the Giro, it's just so special.
So that was Lee Howard. Now we look ahead to Vontu tomorrow, Lionel.
We do, yeah. I don't know if I mentioned it, but I rode it last month. Rode from bottom to top.
We heard you ride it. If anyone's listened to the Friends special has heard Lionel ride Mont Ventoux.
Yeah, rode up there breathing like a set of punctured bagpipes. I would describe my breathing technique was not the best, was it? Let's be honest.
Well, let's hear a little teaser from it, shall we? Again, let's hear a little teaser of Lionel's Friends special from Mont Ventoux.
Ventoux is a special one. It's a mountain which has such tragic stories around it. When you go to the top of Alpe d'Huez, you are not at the top of a mountain. When you go to the top of Ventoux, you're really at the top of the Ventoux. You're really on top of the world.
Especially as a British rider and my history, it's always had that kind of that haunting element to it as well, regards the death of Tommy Simpson and the monument, which always seems so far away. It doesn't matter how many times I do Ventoux, I'm always surprised how close he got to the top. It's always a bit disturbing. I definitely would say I got a love-hate relationship with Mont Ventoux. I've loved it quite a few times. I've hated it probably more.
Become a friend of the podcast for 2016. For £10, you'll have access to our Friends specials, 11 in-depth episodes that will take you even further inside the sport. To sign up, visit www.thecyclingpodcast.com.
So that was a little clip of your Mont Ventoux special, a reminder that you can become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. Thank you very much to everybody who has signed up. And a lot of you have signed up during this Tour de France. So I don't know if you're new listeners or old listeners who've just got round to it. But thank you. Much appreciated.
It's more than much appreciated. It keeps the whole show on the road, doesn't it, Rich? I mean, sponsorship goes a certain way, but we rely on the support of our listeners to help us carry on doing this for free. But I just want to talk about Mont Ventoux, Rich, because when I heard that it had been confirmed that they're going to finish at Chalet Reynard, not go the final 6 kilometres up to the summit, instantly I was disappointed. But then I kind of came to terms with the news, and I kind of think it adds to the myth and the kind of power of Mont Ventoux. The wind is going to be too strong up there. And I also think that it may well affect the race for the better. Riders are already talking about how the run up to the bottom of Mont Ventoux could be very windy. It could split up if it's aggressive. And the section of the mountain that they're going to do is by far the toughest. It actually gets a bit easier after Chalet Reynard. And, of course, if it is windy on Chalet Reynard, it kind of negates the tactics a little bit, because if it's a headwind, then it's very, very difficult to make any difference. It's tempting to just sort of follow the wheels, and you might have seen just a sort of bit of a procession up to the top. Difficult to make differences on that section. So we could see the situation where anyone who wants to make any kind of gain is going to have to do so on the toughest part of the climb through the forest.
I think it makes it sort of more of an unknown, this stage, you know, and the that sense of mystery is really intriguing, and it will, as Froome said, add certain intensity to the stage. So I'm really looking forward to it. Can't wait. Before we go, a quick reminder that we are producing Kilometre to Zero every morning. It's a 15 to 20 minute podcast. Today's was Paul Smith and cycling fashion. Paul Smith, the fashion designer who interviewed in London recently, features him and Richard Williams, the journalist, who has collaborated with him on a book called Paul Smith's Cycling Scrapbook. Now, we have a copy of Paul Smith's Cycling Scrapbook to give away as a prize, and we would like to invite entries. And I hadn't really thought about what those entries might be, but I think if you can tweet us, cycling_podcast, or Facebook, or leave a message on Facebook beneath the post for this particular Kilometre Zero. Tell us your favourite cycling jersey and why. And obviously the why is important there. Tell us why you have a favourite cycling jersey, and the most entertaining will win a copy of this wonderful book.
Lovely.
So that's all for tonight. What's coming up on Kilometre Zero tomorrow? It's Bastille Day.
It is Bastille
Day,
yeah.
French, the two French teams, AG2R and Francis Desjeux in particular, including an interview with Julien Pinot, who is Thibaut Pinot's brother and coach.
And coming up, I think on Friday, a technical hot potato. Let's just leave it there.
Oh, intriguing. In the meantime, thank you very much to Daniel Freeb for joining us, to David Miller, to Ned Bolting for a brief cameo, and thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.